was wonderful to listen to Hans and to just the way that you talked about the glory of God and the way that we are here to glorify God and how that plays a role in our fears. So thank you, Hans. Yesterday, I had a chance to meet with somebody from Goods Church, and it was interesting talking to him about the history of Goods. I learned a lot about the river churches, the churches that now make up the Susquehanna River and the Landisville Manor districts, and just the connection to the chapel from Goods is ridiculous. Chestnut Hill, is that the church that got planted out of there? The Mennonite Mission in Marietta, and all those various connections. I feel like most of you grew up there, or many of you did, so it was good to hear that connection. Today, you all, we're going back to where we left off before Christmas. I must say that I love preaching from the Old Testament better than the New. I shouldn't say that, I know, but I do. The Old Testament is just full. It takes me back to when I was a young child growing up. My parents were deeply concerned about how often I read the Old Testament. When I was a child, that's all I would read is the Old Testament over and over again. Growing up in church, we had three ministers, and they were all uncles from both sides of the family. Well, my dad's side of the family, his mom and his dad's. And so I soon learned that that's the first place I learned that ministers basically have three sermons or three themes, and that's all they talk about. And you're going to see my theme again because it's going to come through. And so I just, during church, I shouldn't say this either, but I just read the Old Testament over and over and over again to fill time as a child. And so particularly Genesis to Second Chronicles, I know fairly well because I read them way too many times as a child. I still don't completely understand my fascination with it. I think as a child growing up feeling rejected and alone, it was a great source of comfort for some bizarre reason. But today we're going to go back to my favorite place. And the other thing that happened, I thought I knew what I was going to be preaching on today, and then I made the mistake. I wanted to get a quick shot of one of my favorite rabbis, and so I listened to it this morning when I was running, and it totally blew up what I was going to say. And so I don't actually know what I'm going to be preaching about today, so we'll see how that goes. So today we are going to go back, and we're going to go back to, so if you remember correctly, before Christmas, we were talking about the patriarchs. We had gone through Abraham, we'd gone through Isaac, we'd gone through Jacob. And again, Jacob, as you all know, is one of the patriarchs I struggle with the most. His life is a complete disaster. He doesn't really turn his life around till the very end. And you all, today, we're going to go back to Jacob. We're going to get back to many of the characters that we've covered before, and they're going to be weaved into the story today. And I do not believe that God wanted Jacob to be where he is in this story. Even though this man has turned the corner, I do not believe that the Jacob we're going to meet in the story is the Jacob that God had originally designed for him to be. But he is there. He is because one of the songs that we sang today that talks about fear, the battle that we all face is the battle between believing God and fear. And you're going to see that Jacob gives in to those fears in the story if I get to them, because I realize how little time I have, and I want to give Robin some space because I could probably go wait till 11:30 and you all would be bored. But we're going to go back to, so if you remember our story, we had gone through Joseph, and again, I will say that Rabbi Foreman, who I love to listen to, is not as big of a fan of Joseph as I am, although I appreciate where he comes from and what he says, and I would argue that his concerns about Joseph match the concerns about Christ and the verse in Hebrews 5 that talks about that Jesus learned through suffering. He learned obedience through suffering. I will agree with Rabbi Foreman that Joseph also learned, that Joseph had to learn through his suffering, and we're going to see that today. But if you remember correctly, we went through Joseph. We got to where he finally, Pharaoh has the dreams. Oh, you all, since we're going to talk about this today, this comes from Rabbi Foreman. He argues that God did not give Joseph the meaning of the dream that Pharaoh had through extraordinary ways, through supernatural ways. He said, when you read the dream, and I'm going to read the dream because this is where we ended up. When two full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream, and he's standing by the Nile when out of the river, this is chapter 41 of Genesis, it's not on the slide, Dan. He stands by the Nile, and when out of the river comes what? Seven cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, seven other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up from the Nile and stood beside them on the riverbank. And the cows were ugly and gaunt, ate those that were sleek and fat, and then Pharaoh woke up. Now here's a different interpretation on this passage, and I want you to think about it because it's going to be important with what I finally get to what I want to talk about today. The Hebrew word for reeds is the same root word that comes from brothers. So if you read this as Joseph, so I try to imagine Joseph standing in front of Pharaoh. Pharaoh is telling him the story, telling him the dream. And so in his Hebrew mind, this is what he would hear. He was standing by the Nile when out of the river came seven cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the brothers. Not among the reeds, but the brothers. And then seven other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up from the Nile, and they stood there among the riverbank. Here's what he believes. Joseph, in his mind, is going, he's thinking, I grew up among the brothers. Where have I heard of somebody who's ugly and somebody who's beautiful before? You all know, right? His mother and his mother's sister. Because the secret to interpreting this dream is what? That seven stands for 7 years. Jacob worked how many years for his wives? 7 years and 7 years. So what he argues is, Joseph looked at this and he said, it's 7 years. Because the secret to interpreting this dream is, what does the seven stand for? And he this is what Rabbi Foreman says, in Joseph's mind he went, ugly. Beautiful. Oh, yeah, I know that. I grew up among my brothers with an ugly bride and a beautiful bride. 7 years, 7 years. That's the secret to the dream. I don't know. Do you think that's how God gave the interpretation to Joseph? It's very possible, isn't it? Because you all, what we're going to get into today is I'm going to argue that Joseph is arguing, is struggling with, who is my father? Is my father Egypt, or is my father my Hebrew father, Jacob? And we're going to watch that struggle today. And so when you think about that in the dream and his pull back to his parents and his home and his wife and that crazy dysfunctional family that he grew up in. The other thing I want you to hang on to, remember Jacob is the what? The heel grabber, the deceiver. Watch how the deceiver and that theme comes back and is redeemed in our story today. So where we're going to pick up is so the last thing we had heard, Joseph had interpreted the Pharaoh's dream, and he said, Pharaoh, what you need to do is you need to appoint somebody who can take and can take the grain in the 7 good years and store them away, and then we'll be able to give them out in the 7 lean years. And Jacob turns to his advisors, and he says, where are we going to find a man like this? And they say, Joseph, you're our man. They give it to Joseph, and so that's where we left off. We left off with the verse where, in verse 39, and then we'll finally get to my slide, Dan. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made this all known to you, there is no one as discerning and as wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your order. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. Verse 41, where we're going to start. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. He dressed him in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain on his neck. He made him ride in a chariot as a second in command, and people shouted before him, make way. Or it could say, and probably should say, bow down. Make way, and then he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift a hand or foot in Egypt. Pharaoh gave Joseph the name, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it because my pronunciation is horrible. And then he gave him a wife, who I'm not going to try to pronounce. All I know is that her father was the priest of On. And Joseph went throughout the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Joseph went out of Pharaoh's presence and traveled throughout Egypt. During the 7 years of abundance, the land produced plentiful, and Joseph collected all the foods in the 7 years of abundance in Egypt and stored them in the cities. In each city, he had food grown in the fields surrounding it. Joseph stored up huge quantities of grain, like the sand of the sea. It was so much that they kept records. They stopped keeping records because it was beyond measure. You all, that's a lot of food. That is a lot of food. Now, we're going to start there, and then we're going to come back and finish this reading. Up until now, So here's the theme that I want you to see. When you look at Joseph's life, here's what happens. He has a dream, or somebody has a dream. There's gifts, and then he ends up in a pit. It happens at home with his brothers. He has a dream. By the way, first his dad gives him the what? The coat of many colors. A beautiful gift. One of the themes in Joseph's stories are clothing. Cloaks, things that he wears. He gets this coat of many colors from his father, an ornate coat, an extra coat that meant what, you all? You are my favorite, and more importantly to his brothers, you are the true firstborn of my family. It's not your brother Reuben who is the real firstborn. It is Joseph, the positional firstborn. What happens, though? His brothers then get angry with him. They strip off of his coat. He ends up in the pit. He goes to Egypt as a slave. He gets gifts. He becomes the leader of the home that he ends up in. His wife has his master's wife has a fantasy, not a dream this time, but a fantasy. Joseph's coat is stripped off of him again. He ends up in the dungeon, which is the same word there is used as the word pit. He ends up in the pit again. He gets out of the pit here in our story, and he comes up, and Pharaoh does what? Pharaoh does a number of things. He gives him gifts. He gets to wear the gold chain. He's no longer wearing the chains of a slave, but he's wearing a gold chain. What else does he get? This is the most important one in Joseph's theme. He gets, what kind of coat does he get this time? What kind of a piece of clothing does he get? It's a robe of fine linen. You all, what does clothing mean to put on and put off clothes in the Bible? A new life. This is Joseph's new life. His life of sin, his life of all the other stuff, all those other things have been stripped away from him. Now he gets put onto him a new robe and a new gold chain and a signet ring that says, you get to be, anything you do is from me. This is Joseph's turning point. This is Joseph's redemption in his story. This is when he goes from being a slave to sin to being a new creature in Christ. Figuratively, because Christ is not in the picture yet. But this is the precursors to what change takes place with us in Christ. We take off our old, we end up in the pit, and God pulls us from the pit and restores us to a position of honor and gives us fine robes of linen. Wow. That is cool. And we get to see it buried in the story of Joseph right here. So Joseph gets all of these things, and then he gets to what? Ride in a chariot where people run in front of him and say, bow down, here comes Joseph, bow down, make way, bow down, make way. Right, someday. Joseph is our type of Christ. You're going to get tired of this today, but man, Joseph just becomes Christ today. One day, every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord. Just like Joseph gets placed in this position, and he becomes a type of Christ, where one day Christ will be honored in the same way, where every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord. Joseph then goes about, remember he doubled the taxes, I'm sure that made him a favorite politician, but he doubles the taxes from 10% to 20%. The Egyptians had to give him 20% of their grain. I'm sure they loved it. He had such big piles. Again, I remember driving a couple years ago, probably 3 years or 4 years ago, and that big pile of grain sticks in my head because it just drove me anxious. Because I drove by that and thought, man, there's going to be water all over that grain all the time. That big pile of grain down here on 441, I just imagine those fields around those towns, just heaps of grain, whatever grain they had. Joseph, they collected so much grain they didn't even know what to do. It was beyond measure. And then the 7 bad years come. But we're going to get to that. So Joseph is collecting all this grain. And then, what verse is it? Oh, verse 50. Nope, sorry. Yeah, verse 50. Before the years of famine came, so here's the turning point, 2 sons were born to Joseph by his wife. Oh, you all. People really struggle with Joseph's wife. I just want to tell you. It's been a big struggle across time. Why did Joseph marry who he married? He married an Egyptian. People get really hung up on this, and I understand. It's a point of controversy. God had told them what? Don't marry Canaanite women. Did that extend to Egyptian women? Did Joseph do something wrong here when he took a wife? Well, he didn't have hardly a choice. Pharaoh wanted to make sure that he didn't smell like a Hebrew. He wanted to make sure that he looked like a Egyptian, so he gives him an Egyptian name. Lots of debate about his name. Who knows what his name means? I've given up. I don't even know. I can't figure out. I don't know if we'll ever know what it means. But he also gives him an Egyptian wife so that he has an Egyptian wife so he looks Egyptian. Now, you all, some Jewish scholars have gone so far, talk about old characters that reemerge. They argue that his wife was really the adopted daughter of Dinah and Shechem. That seems like a stretch to me. But they argue that when Shechem and Dinah had their... When Shechem raped Dinah, the child that came out of that was this little girl. She was left off at some Egyptian's household who raised her. I don't know. That seems like a lot to me. I just don't... I think she was an Egyptian. Because I think it adds to the struggle that Joseph is having here. Am I an Egyptian or am I a Hebrew? Anyways, he has a son. His firstborn son is named Manasseh. Manasseh sounds like what? Forgot. And he said, it is because God has made me forget all my troubles and my father's household. We'll get to that. The second son he named Ephraim and said, which sounds like what? Fruitful in the Hebrew. It is because God has made me fruitful in the land of suffering. In those 7 years of good years, Joseph and his wife have 2 sons. You all. Those 2 sons become the tribes of Israel. They are the double blessing that Joseph got as the firstborn. This is where they come from. We talked about that before. Reuben gets bumped out of that position. His father had already bumped him out of that position, but then when he slept with one of his father's wives, he got stripped of that officially, and Joseph becomes the firstborn, and here we see the double blessing. Manasseh, which means what? To forget. And what does he say here? God has made me forget all my troubles in my father's household. Do I think that he forgot about his father completely? No. See, here's my thoughts. Don't have any support of this, but I try to imagine what it must have been like for Joseph. When Joseph leaves his family, his father has his back completely. I think Joseph spent these years thinking, my dad's going to come and rescue me at any time. He has waited 13 long years for his dad to show up to rescue him, and his dad never does. Don't we sometimes wait 13 or more years for God to show up, and he never does? But Joseph is saying here, listen, God has made me forget the struggling and suffering that I went through. What I love about this is Joseph doesn't say, I never struggled, I never had any sorrow. He acknowledges his sorrow. He acknowledges his loss. He acknowledges that he doesn't get to see his family for 13 years. But then he goes on and says, you know what? In my second son, my God, God has made me twice fruitful. God has made me fruitful despite my sufferings, despite my loss of my family, despite the pain that I feel, despite the disappointment that I have in my father for not showing up. God has been with me. And he has been faithful and allowed me to be fruitful. I want you to contrast that to his father's struggle when we get to his father's struggle. Because I think the Lord wants us to be like Joseph here, where we acknowledge our pain, we acknowledge our suffering, we acknowledge our heartbreak around family often, you all. But we say, God is faithful. Even when He does not speak, I know that He is faithful. Even when it does not appear that God is working, God is working. 53. The 7 years of abundance in Egypt came to an end. The 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the land, but in the whole land of Egypt there was food. When all of Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. When Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph and do what he tells you." When the famine spread over all the whole country, Joseph opened up all the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt, and all the world came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe everywhere. Just like Joseph had predicted, famine comes. And those 7 years are really bad. The first people that suffered the famine were outside of Egypt, probably due to the Nile, right? They had the Nile. The Nile was there. The Nile flooded, and that gave them moisture. And so they probably, and again, I think God had this happen where Joseph ended up in Egypt because the Nile was there. So they had water longer than the other countries. If you read that passage, you get to see that the famine hit outside of Egypt before it hit Egypt. But eventually it got to Egypt. Pharaoh says, the Egyptians come to Pharaoh and they say, "Pharaoh, what do we do?" He says, "Go to Joseph and do what he tells you." By the way, remember we talked about this before. Joseph had been prepared to be a good administrator because he became the administrator of Potiphar's house. Then he ended up in prison. He became a minister there, administrator there. He's 30 years old, you all. And he gets to run an entire social service, food support in a major country, and gets to supply food for the entire world. Now, how in the world does Joseph here represent a type of Christ? Now, some people say that Pharaoh, when he said, "Go to Joseph and do what he tells you," was mimicking or foretelling when Jesus performed his first miracle. I think this is a little bit of a stretch. But when Jesus performed his miracle, what did his mother say to the people? "Go to Jesus and do whatever he says." Isn't it interesting? Go to Joseph and do whatever he says. What are the parallels between Joseph here, though, and Christ? There's a number of them. Number one, he's a messenger from God. He speaks the truth about the future. He is the bread of life. He feeds the people the bread of life, just like Jesus. And he was given authority from a higher authority, God, Jesus, voluntarily. Pharaoh, Joseph, voluntarily. Many parallels between Joseph and his salvation that he represents and what he brings to the people by feeding them the bread of life and what Jesus does when he feeds us the bread of life. You know, the part that still blows my mind, the part that still troubles me sometimes and makes me a little queasy, God arranged this entire worldwide famine to do one thing: to bring Joseph and his brothers together and to demonstrate his power, to bring glory to his name. But the entire world is impacted so that Joseph gets to reunite with his brothers so that redemption can happen to this messed up, horribly dysfunctional, absolutely bottom of the barrel family to become what God wants them to become. Because this next chapter just blows my mind. Because I try to imagine, you all, put yourself in Joseph's shoes. You've been away from your family for 13 years. You're rebuilding your life in Egypt, and it's going quite well. And you're beginning to wonder, am I really an Egyptian? Maybe I should just get rid of my Hebrew background. Maybe I should just settle into my Egyptian lifestyle. Maybe Pharaoh should become my father, and I should forget my father of the past. And then chapter 42 happens, and I think, I can't imagine how this wrecked Joseph. Chapter 42, verse 1. You all, this chapter is just so loaded with some of the things we've talked about before, and so many things just impinge on this and make this chapter it just drips with so much stuff. Anyway, sorry. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you keep looking at each other?" You all, the Hebrew says, "Why do you guys keep looking at each other with strange looks?" do. Sorry, I sound like Joe Biden there. We all know why they do, right? We know why. We know why they have that inquisitive look on their face. Their dad wants them to do what? He wants them to go to Egypt. And this dysfunctional family filled of deception and secrets, what's the big secret these brothers have? They sent their brother to Egypt. Their dad wants them to go to Egypt. That's why they looked at each other and they said, what are we going to do? He continued, after he said, why do you guys look at each other so strangely? I heard there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some so that we may live and not die. Now, you all, these boys are not teenagers. They're probably in their 30s. Late 30s, maybe early 40s. They have families. But in this culture, you tell your adult sons what to do. Verse 3, then 10 of Joseph's 12 brothers went to buy grain in Egypt. Why was there only 10? Look at here. We know, remember, see, these brothers, they had to live with the secret for 13 years. They got to watch their father do what? Grieve Joseph's loss those 13 years. They had to feel the guilt and the shame of their deception by telling their father that their brother was dead. The 10 brothers went down to Egypt to buy grain, but Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to him. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for there was famine in the land of Canaan also. You all, Jacob is so, he has become, he's no longer that cocky heel grabber that he was at birth. He is now an old man, wrecked by grief, wrecked by regret, and wrecked by fear. He says, I am not sending Benjamin to go and die. I lost Joseph. I lost my favorite son. And I lost his mother, my favorite wife, which he blamed himself for, most likely because he condemned her to death, right? He has become a shell of the man that he once was. He is no longer the deceiver. He is wrecked by fear, and he says, I'm not going to let Benjamin go with you. Which again, what does that tell the other 10? I don't care as much about you as I care about Benjamin. Verse 6. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, as if we didn't know. The people who sold grain to all the people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him and their faces to the ground. And as soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. Where did you come from? You all. I try to imagine this scene. It's amazing. It's a miracle. It's a miracle from God that Joseph actually happened to be in the place where his brothers, because how many boatloads of people came through that place. Why Joseph was there, ordained by God to be there, he shouldn't have necessarily been there when his brothers show up. So I imagine Joseph is just kind of boredly doing his thing. He looks up and he sees these guys. And he recognizes them as brothers. Can you imagine his heart rate at that moment? He's just kind of going along, doing his thing. All of a sudden, I don't know if you've ever been a place you've seen somebody you don't want to see. The adrenaline that shot must have shot through Joseph must have been great. The cortisol levels that if you could have measured them would have been sky high. He's like, wow, they're my brothers. He wanted to see them but didn't want to see them, right? How quickly do you think it took him to count them and say, oh, one's missing? He must have looked a little different. Did he figure out Benjamin was missing right away? I don't know. You haven't seen him for 13 years. He had to hide all of that response, right? He pretended to be a stranger. He spoke harshly to them. Where did you come from, he asked. From the land of Canaan, they replied, to buy food. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dream about them. By the way, don't you think the next line, and he said to them, should read, I told you so. Don't you remember that dream I had? It just happened, guys. Get off the ground. Stop bowing to me. Didn't I tell you you were going to do this? He doesn't do that. He's not quite as cocky as he was when he was 17 years old. By the way, some commentators believe that Joseph was about to tell him who he was until he remembered the dream and he thought, oh, God has a bigger plan. I shouldn't do it now. Because it's interesting that it falls into there right now, isn't it? It's a weird place to put that. But he remembers the dream. The dream has come true. He doesn't say that. What does he say to them? You are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected. And a family of deceivers, here's another deception going on. For the good of the glory of God. No, my Lord, they answered. Your servants come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. Your servant, by the way, family of deceivers. What do they just say? Your servants are honest men. This family doesn't know honesty if it bit them in the face. Right? Your servants are honest men, not spies. No, he said to them. You have come to see where our land is unprotected. But they replied, your servants, by the way, this is where they're going to step right into the trap. Your servants are 12 brothers, the son of one man who lives in Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more. I wonder who they're talking about. And where is he that he's no more? Oh, this is such a loaded story. Ah, it's beautiful. It's just full of so much intrigue. I will say this. I can imagine that Joseph's shot of adrenaline went through him again when he said, the one is with our father. Benjamin's alive. He gets what he wants. He knows that Benjamin is alive. Joseph said to them, it is just as I told you. You are spies. And this is how you will be tested. Here comes the test. See, you all, I believe that this is a God-ordained test to bring redemption and to restore these brothers to the position they needed to be so that they could find a place of relief from their guilt and their shame because of forgiveness. And because, see, just like Jesus, Joseph recognizes them before they recognize us. Jesus recognizes us in our state of sin before we recognize it. And he provides the chance to get out of our guilt and our shame through forgiveness that he gives before we even ask. And you're going to see that get played out in this story. Joseph said to them, it is just as I told you, you are spies. This is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your younger brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. By the way, think about how he changes this. Send one brother home and I'm going to keep nine right now is what he's saying. Let's see where you are. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your word will be tested so I can see if you are telling the truth. This is going to be a common theme in a family of deceptors. It is, if you are not, then surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies. And he put them all in custody for 3 days. 3 days matches 3 days of Christ in the tomb. On the third day, Joseph said to them, do this and you will live, for I fear God. Joseph gave them a clue of who he was. I fear Yahweh. Now, again, they're so concerned. They're so worried. They're like, I just can't imagine these brothers. They're just got to be wrecked. They got to be wrecked. If you are an honest man, again, honest, 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 honest. That theme gets driven through in this chapter in contrast to this deceptive family that exists. Let one of your brothers stay in prison. He's gone from 9 to 1. Let the rest of you go home. Take your grain to your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me, so that your word may be verified and you may not die. Right? Christ protects us from the death that should be ours. This they proceeded to do. Then they said to one another, surely we are being punished. Here's their guilt and shame. Surely we are being punished because our brother, we didn't know this before. We saw his distress when he pleaded for us for his life. Can you imagine what that must have been like when Joseph pleaded for his life with his brothers and they disregarded it? He was rejected by his own and he comes back to save them. Again, like Christ. But we would not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. We are being punished for what we did. Reuben, who's always trying to be the firstborn, those bossy firstborns of those of you who have firstborns, those of you who are firstborns, I'm sorry. Didn't I tell you? This is so unlike Joseph. He said, he points his finger at them and says, I told you so. Remember Reuben had the plan, put him in the pit, and he said, I want to come back. We don't know where Reuben went, but Reuben was, he had this perfect plan. He was going to pull him out of the pit and send him home. Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? You would not listen to me. Now we're given an account for his blood. But here's the secret, you all. They did not realize that Joseph could understand them since he was using an interpreter. Joseph hears them. Can you imagine what that must have done to Joseph's heart? For him to say, my brothers who sold me into slavery, they've come a long way. Their hearts are breaking. They're feeling guilt. He turned away from them and began to weep. Of course he did. Then he came back and spoke to them. He had Simon. We don't know why he picked Simon. I'm hoping that Simon volunteered. The story should tell you it should have been Reuben or Judah because they were the big players in this story. But somehow Simon gets chosen. I hope he said, pick me. I'm going to go with that, but we don't really know. Simon taken from them and he was bound in front of their eyes. Joseph sets up this tremendous object lesson. He takes Simon, he binds him, he sends him off to prison handcuffed. Can you imagine those brothers seeing their brother bound and taken away? Much like Joseph was. Joseph gave the orders to fill their bags and to put each of the man's silver back in his sack to give them provisions for their journey. This was done for them. They loaded their grain on their donkeys and left. At the place where they stopped for the night, one of them opened the sack to get feed for his donkey, and he saw that the silver was in his sack. My silver has been returned, he said to his brothers, here in my sack. Their hearts sank. They turned to each other and trembled and said to each other, what is this that God has done to us? The fear that says, oh no. You'd think this is a great thing, right? In a family of deceivers, we got our money back. We didn't have to pay a thing for that. The fear of God has taken a hold of them. They're saying, what is God doing? Can you imagine what these brothers thought in that long journey back to Canaan? I'm sure they had many conversations. What in the world are we going to tell Dad? How do we explain Simon? How do we explain the silver? Will he ever let Simon go? Will he let Benjamin go, or will he let Simon die in prison? I think they were pretty convinced that Jacob would let their brother die in prison rather than to risk Benjamin going back home with them, back to Egypt with them. Poor Reuben. The theory is, because he was the firstborn, Reuben had to go back and tell his dad that Joseph was dead, quote unquote. Reuben now has to go back and tell his dad again, one of your other sons is gone. They get back home. When they came to the father in the land of Canaan, they told him all the things that had happened to them. And they said, the man who is lord over the country spoke harshly to us and treated us though we were spies in the land. We said to him, we are honest men. There it goes again. We are not spies. We are 12 brothers, one son of one father. One is no more, and the younger one is now with our father in Canaan. The man who was lord over the land said to us, this is how I will know you are honest men. Leave one of my brothers here and take your food for your starving households and gold. Go, bring your youngest brother to me so that I will know that you are not spies but honest men. And then I will give your brother back to you and you can trade in the land. As we were emptying our sacks, each man's sack was his pouch of silver. And when their father saw the money pouches, they were frightened. They're frightened all over again. Their father said to them, listen to this, you all. This is such a condemning statement. Their father Jacob said to them, you have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more and Simon is no more. Simon's not no more. He's alive. Right? He's in prison, but he's alive. Now what has he said? Now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me. I'll finish this, but we're not going to talk about it today. Then Reuben said to his father, Reuben the firstborn, really but doesn't get credit for it from his father. You may put both of my sons, I'll take you all. If Benjamin comes back and he doesn't come back, you can have two for the price of one, right? Giving back double. You can kill two of my sons if I do not bring Benjamin back. To entrust him to my care, and I will bring him back. Jacob said, my son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead. He is the only one left. If harm comes to him on the journey you are taking, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow. You all, this is where we get to see Jacob. Jacob is broken. Jacob is bound by fear. He's bound by grief. He thinks everything is against him. That line where he says, everything is against me. This is the man who has been chosen by God to be the patriarch. He is wealthy. He is healthy. And he says, everything is against me. He has lost his favorite wife, his favorite son, and that's all he can think about. But you all, that's where we are. We so often get caught when God allows for us to experience loss in life. We get caught on what we don't have. What Jacob doesn't know, because Jacob doesn't know the entire picture yet, is that behind the scenes, God has been working all along to bring salvation to him and his family. God has been working behind the scenes that his loss of Joseph early on in his life is going to be the result in the salvation of all of them. When it doesn't seem like God is working, God is working. We don't get to see that, though. I wish God would give us a little more hint. But I want to go back to that verse which says, even Jesus, when he was the Son, learned obedience through suffering. There's something about being in the fallen world that we do, that we learn something through suffering. I wish it wasn't so. I would love it if we didn't have to suffer. But again, Romans 8:28 says what? In the end, all things will be worked out to good for those that trust God. That's a horrible paraphrase on my part, that are called to be according to his purpose. You all, that seems so shallow sometimes. It seems so hollow. But in this case of Jacob, how do we not look at the waves, and how do we keep our focus on Jesus despite the waves of life? I don't always know, because I don't do it. Those waves are big. Those waves come hard. But how do we shift our focus so that we're not looking at what we don't have like Jacob does in this passage, and look at Joseph and say, I lost my family. I lost who I was. But I know that God has made me fruitful, and he's been faithful despite all those losses. That's what we all have to do. And is that easy? It is not. And again, that's the theme of the story. Now, there's some really fun things coming up yet, you all. We're going to get to them in the next couple of weeks. Judah, one of my favorite, remember Judah and Tamar? That story is going to come back in an amazingly redemptive way. That horrible, yucky, shower-producing story that we had to read. We're going to get to see the redemption part of that one coming up too, because that is really cool, because that was a really cool turning point in Judah's life. Judah, the one that Jesus comes out of. Oh, the other thing? No, that's coming up. Sorry. We'll get to it. Let's pray. Father, we do thank you for the fact that you are working all things for your good. Father, please forgive us when we get so caught up in the waves. I'm just glad that you know the pain that we feel, because you felt that pain too. Father, I'm grateful that you too felt pain of loss, pain of broken relationships, that you know what that's like, and that you can be there for us and can walk with us. Father, we thank you so much that you don't condemn us for that, but that you walk with us and encourage us to move past that. Thank you that you continue to work in our lives even when we can't see it. Father, help us to cling to that, and forgive us when we can't. In your name, amen.